Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Welcome to Your True North. I'm your host, Cindy Camp. Your True North is a program that explores values as a compass for life's journey. Today, I will be talking with Dennis Cohn, who was raised in the Mennonite Church and is now a member of the First Unitarian Church of Chicago. For many years, he has worked with not-for-profit organizations and churches as a management consultant. When he was in his early 50s, Dennis returned to school to pursue a doctoral degree to explore Christian perspectives on war. As a young man during the Vietnam War, Dennis chose to spend 18 months in federal prison as a draft resister rather than do the community service offered by the U.S. government. It is my pleasure to welcome you, Dennis Cohn. I typically like to start out asking guests about their childhood experiences and particularly where you grew up.
I grew up in North Newton, Kansas, out on the plains, and was born in 1952, so lived through the 50s and the 60s. I was right next to Bethel College, which is a very good Mennonite liberal arts college, and found that to be a setting for many good friends and eventually mentors. One of the stories that my mother tells that's one of my favorites is that we lived right on campus, and I was accessible to students and teachers there, and was observed regularly by a child development psychology class for 2 years. And my mother reports that I was always performing ahead of schedule. So that was a fun story to remember. Before long, I was active in athletic activities, and I remember a local punt, pass, and kick contest, which I won several years running in grade school. I remember finding a grade card from fifth grade a few years ago and seeing that at the end of the year, my teacher wrote, "Dennis has all the traits of leadership, including the ability to manage people without arousing resentment." And I think I have been following that script for a number of decades now.
Yeah, that certainly sounds like a teacher who understood you well already as a young person. What about key formative events or people in your childhood?
Another one of my teachers was very formative, a woman named Betty Holderreed. I remember she really taught us not just to absorb information, but to think of the creative power of the mind to solve problems. So early on, I moved into that kind of mode of education of looking at understanding problems and looking for ways to solve them. A few years later, and this jumps all the way into my prison time, another very influential person was Father Timothy Ondahl, a Catholic chaplain at the federal prison where I was in Englewood, Colorado. And he described himself as an advocate for the powerless, earlier with farm workers and in that context with prison inmates. So he was not afraid to stir up some level of tension with the security force there in the prison or with the administration as an advocate for inmates. So there were some crucial people that shaped my life early on.
And what about your religious background? I know you grew up in a Mennonite church and you mentioned Bethel College. Were your parents working at the college? Is that how you ended up growing up really on the campus there?
Right. My father was the manager of the buildings and grounds department there, so a very practical role. Before I was born, my mother was the dietitian and in charge of the food service for the entire campus. Later, she retooled and went back as a reference librarian there. So we were very intimately connected with that college community, and that was a great way to grow up. It was some of the kind of safety and security of small town life in the Midwest, but also with a global perspective, with people coming and going from around the world. So that was important. And in my church growing up, there were a lot of professional people, college professors, Mennonite agency administrators, mental health professionals from a Mennonite facility called Prairie View Mental Health Center. And I think I absorbed some of the basic foundational values of the Mennonite tradition. I think of those as including community, stewardship, service to others, international development, nonviolent peacemaking, and seeing ethical principles in the life and teachings of Jesus.
You know, your mentioning of the core principles of the Mennonite tradition leads me to my next question, which is to ask you about your own core values. Can you identify some of those?
Right. A few years ago, I gave myself concerted attention on that question as I tried to think about the foundation for my management consulting practice. One of the values that came to the top of my list was mutuality, both in terms of interpersonal relationships and professional relationships. And I think of that as the building of relationships that enhance beneficial exchanges. So it's not independence, it's not dependence, but it's that kind of synthesis of interdependence. So mutuality is a big one. Another that comes to my mind quickly is that of health. Health for individuals and for social systems and institutions and structures that I work with. This might be part of a parenting philosophy. I know that when I became a parent about 26 years ago, I decided to influence my daughter by giving positive feedback on what she does well. And in her adult years, she's given me the response that was very unusual, that she doesn't run into very many of her peers that had that kind of positive parenting. So health is one area. Another value that has become more and more central to me through the years is that of empathy, knowing the deep thoughts and feelings of others. Again, I applied that early on in my role as a parent of seeking to enter my daughter's world each day to kind of talk with her and participate in the world that she lived in. So those are some of the values that are rather intimate and personal. Another one is to see actions in a global context and to work at expanding opportunities for all people. And that's more and more of a challenge with 7 billion people in the world. And with greater disparities all the time, that will be one of humanity's greatest challenges, I think, to think about our individual actions in that global context. Another value that has surfaced over the years for me is foresight, and that is to consider the long-term impact of decisions and actions. So often we're tied to simply the moment or the quarter or the annual report, but to think more long-term, I think, is very important for us these days. Another value might not be articulated by too many people in the way that I'm going to say this, but that is the value of elegance. And by that, I mean simplicity, of trying to work with complex situations and use simple models to describe those complex realities. I often like, when I'm working with a client, to summarize an issue or a problem or an opportunity on one page, so we can kind of see the many facets and how that fits together. And then the last one I'm thinking of became central in my consulting practice about 15 years ago, and that's the value of synergy. And I think of this as the unleashing of creative energy, often by bringing diverse elements, people, resources, ideas together in new relationships to serve a noble purpose. And the relationship part is the crucial part there, where the creativity and the innovation and the novelty comes up. And I began using a business slogan, igniting synergy in human systems. So that's a pretty a substantial list of core values, but I do think of these quite often in my daily activities.
Well, as you've talked about your values, I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how you've identified those particular values, if your religious tradition was a part of that, if your parents had a big influence, or other experiences. You mentioned travel.
Well, I'm thinking for a minute here. I think most of these values gained some clarity for me by thinking about my management consulting practice. I remember going to some conferences on emotional intelligence and the value of empathy had been highlighted in the research there. Or I attended some conference of the World Future Society, and the value of foresight came to my attention in that setting. And then the value of synergy, which is central to my professional work today, really originate, I think, from the writings of Stephen Covey. So rubbing shoulders with people in a wide range of disciplines was probably a key way for me to kind of uncover and articulate these values.
And I know we referred just briefly to your time in prison, and I'd like to ask you a little bit more about that now. You were a young man, and you made a very conscious decision not only not to serve in the military during the Vietnam War, but you made the choice to go to prison, which was unusual, even among conscientious objectors. I'd like to just to ask you to reflect on that experience for us and your thoughts at the time and your thoughts now about that.
I turned 18 in the middle of my senior year in high school. It was January 1970. So Richard Nixon was in the White House. We had already seen many years of war under the Lyndon Johnson administration. The reality of the war was brought home to the living rooms of millions of Americans every night on the evening news. And the more I learned about this war, the more it appeared to have no purpose, or it wasn't grounded really in politics or in ethics. Mennonites traditionally, since World War II, had followed the law and applied to be conscience objectors and did a lot of good work. My father served for 5 years in a civilian public service camp in World War II. I knew people about my age that served in hospitals or were teachers overseas. So there were a good number of things that could be done that were productive. But I felt like all of these ways of alternative service in some ways silenced the critique of American foreign policy. And I really wasn't willing to be silenced. So instead, I decided when I turned 18, a few weeks after that, to write a letter to my draft board, the president, my senator, my congressional representative, saying that I was opposed to the Selective Service system and the way that it was integrated into the military and into U.S. foreign policy. So I was looking for a way to slow down or stop the war at that time. I didn't have any big pretensions that I as an individual could do that, but there was a bit of a movement already. I had started subscribing to a little newsletter. I think it was called Chicago Area Draft Resistors. So here I was in small town Kansas, but the thinking and the political activity of Chicago was having some influence on me. So I think taking my responsibility seriously as a citizen, perhaps in the tradition of the American Henry David Thoreau, who articulated the moral basis for civil disobedience several centuries ago, I think, that when a law is unjust, inappropriate, dangerous, destructive, we can identify a moral imperative to break that law. So I decided to do that openly and publicly, and then allow the legal system to proceed as it would.
You're listening to Your True North, a show that explores how values act as a compass for life's journey. Now let's return to the program, Already in Progress.
What was the response of your family and friends at that time? Because again, even though you had a family tradition, the Mennonite background, your father having done alternative service during World War II, you were very young, just turning 18, to be making these large decisions and the courage to write a letter to the president and to the draft board. How did the people around you respond?
Probably a month or two before I turned 18, I discussed this with my parents, and they were alarmed by the risks that I was taking on. And I think in their minds, they wanted me to talk with some of the respected leaders of my community to see if those folks would talk some sense into me. And we decided on two. One was William Keeney, the academic dean at Bethel College. And he had been involved nationally with a Mennonite peacemaking organization with an office in Washington. So he was very well versed on the issues. And the second was my pastor, a man named Esko Lowen, that our family had known for quite a while. And I met privately and individually with these two leaders separately. And out of both of those conversations, they said, "Dennis, we understand what you're considering here, and we will back you all the way." And so my parents' plan backfired. Instead of these leaders talking sense into me, they really gave me very, very strong encouragement and ratification and lent me their full support. And in fact, eventually both of them appeared on my behalf in my trial in U.S. District Court in Wichita, Kansas.
Would you say more about your trial? Because that's another element of this, beyond just the time in prison, having to be on trial. What did that feel like?
Yeah. I was arrested by the FBI in the first week of my first year of college. And that school year was devoted to various hearings and legal procedures. And toward the end of the year, May and June, my trial was held and I was sentenced. And to accommodate the anxiety of my parents, I decided to hire an attorney. And he was interested in some technical constitutional issues. So I pleaded not guilty. And we pushed the court to clarify the meaning of the draft law and whether this was simply an information gathering process or whether the government was demanding symbolic acquiescence to the government and to its foreign policy. I remember we relied upon a Jehovah's Witness case in federal court during World War II. And kind of pushed that issue. Could the government require symbolic acquiescence? The trial judge sidestepped that. We decided not to have a jury trial. We wanted to press these more technical legal questions. So I was found guilty, I think, in May of my first year of college, at the end of that year. In June, went back for sentencing. We had requested a two-year adult sentence, something that would be concrete and have a definite endpoint to it. But instead, the judge decided to sidestep his sentencing responsibility, and he sentenced me as a youthful offender under the Youth Corrections Act, which I later learned in prison was nicknamed as the Zip 6. And that meant that the federal government, through prison and parole, could control me for up to 6 years. So in some ways, that was a frightening possibility, but that was the judge's prerogative and his decision. I ended up serving 18 months in a federal prison, which was about average, and that was determined by a parole board in Washington. It was about average for draft resistors.
The enormity of this is striking me even more forcefully when I think back to, in my own life, being 18 years old and how little I knew of the world. This must have taken enormous moral courage. I'm sure you had deep principles, but there must have also been deep fear for you about this process and what lay at the other end of a sentencing.
There was anxiety, certainly. I remember in that initial meeting with William Keeney, he handed me a small mimeographed stack of papers that he had received at a recent conference. And another Mennonite, J.R. Burkholder, had authored this short paper titled An Ethical Analysis of Mennonite Draft Resistance. And he, in turn, was drawing upon a model of ethical reasoning that he had picked up from his teacher at Harvard Divinity School, a man named Ralph Potter, who later was my teacher. So that I had a rather sophisticated model for thinking about how we make important ethical decisions. It has to do with how we see God and human nature, what kind of loyalties we have, how we see the empirical situation, what's going on on the ground, and then what goes into good reasoning, whether we talk about consequences or motives or means or ends, those kinds of things. So one way of facing my fears was to pick up on what looked like a pretty comprehensive way to think about ethics. And of course, looking back on this, this was probably quite astounding for a 17 or an 18-year-old to wrap his mind around. But somehow it made sense to me. And then shortly after I was investigated by the FBI while I was still in high school, a man in my church came to me. His name was Willard Unruh. And he said, "Dennis, it looks like you might go to prison. You should really open up your eyes and know what prisons are like. I've been part of a regular program at a state prison nearby, the Kansas State Industrial Reformatory in Hutchinson, Kansas. And each week, a group of us Christians go in and meet with inmates in the chapel and have a worship service and conversation. Would you like to join us?" And I said, "Yeah, that sounds great." So here, my church community was gathering around me and allowing me to have the experiences and the knowledge to sort of get ready. So I think it was about a year and a half that once a week I was going with this bunch of mostly Mennonites to a local state prison and getting a sense of what prisons are like, what inmates are like. And there again, the fears I had were diminished greatly just by that kind of direct personal involvement.
I'm curious. I know for many people who go to prison because they've taken a stand on something, and I'm thinking of Gandhi, and I'm thinking of Martin Luther King and Ghaffar Khan, people who said that prison was really a place where they learned things. You know, there might have been very difficult aspects of it, but there were also tremendously positive things that came out of their time in prison. And I'm just wondering for you if there's anything that, as you look back, I think you kept a diary while you were there. Anything that you learned or that, you know, happened along the way that sort of helped form the person you became as an adult?
It was a tremendous learning experience for me. Some of my college colleagues would spend a semester or a year in a foreign country, in another culture, and be enriched by that kind of cross-cultural experience. And I came to see my prison time in terms like that, that it was really a cross-cultural experience. There was no clear majority group in the federal prison there in Englewood, Colorado. I think the whites were the largest group at about 40%, and then fairly evenly divided groups of African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans. All of the crimes committed on Indian reservations are considered federal offenses, to my knowledge, so that those people, Indian fellows, were ending up in this prison. So there was this wide kind of rainbow of American ethnic groups in my midst. Initially, all the inmates in this prison were in large barracks rooms. So you were eating, sleeping, working with everybody in the prison context. And I developed really good relationships with people across all of these ethnic groups and traditions. So just learning to be comfortable with and understand the stories and background and respect. You know, as we look at the American scene today with a lot of tension around law enforcement and the experience of African-American communities, I got a head start on kind of bridging some of those gaps and building those kind of relationships early on. So I gained a sense of that kind of ethnic diversity. And of course, prisons are mostly filled with the poor and the powerless. And I came away thinking that there was a place for some punitive response for the breaking of laws. But I think there's a point of diminishing returns. I can see punishing people for maybe a year as a kind of symbolic statement. But I think any punishment beyond a year becomes detrimental to the individual and to the society. So I think it breeds recidivism, and for those so inclined, it becomes a kind of school on becoming a better criminal. So I think America today has created one of its most substantial crises, in that we lock up more people per capita than any country on the face of the earth, and it probably robs our country of a great deal of resources at local, state, and federal level. So I think we've created a criminal justice system that really doesn't protect us maybe in the same way that we've created a military system that really doesn't bring us security.
This is part one of a two-part show. Join us again next week to hear the conclusion of our conversation.
You've been listening to Your True North with Cindy Camp. The opinions expressed on today's episode are not necessarily those of WXAV 88.3 FM, St. Xavier University, or the producers of Your True North. For a copy of today's program, you can download it as a podcast by visiting yourtruenorthpodcasts.com. Thank you very much for listening to Your True North.